WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The film Rocky made Sylvester Stallone a star, but it also made the film's producers Robert Chartoff and Erwin Winkler very happy. They were able to take their homes out of hock into which they'd put them to finish the film. But financial arrangements are just part of the producer's life. My guest today is producer Erwin Winkler, who along with Chartoff produced some of the most imaginative films of the past 20 years, from Point Blank to Raging Bull, The Right Stuff, and Round Midnight. Some of their films made tremendous amounts of money, some have not, but the filmmakers took risks which created some startling and compelling movies. They've garnered 11 Academy Awards and 38 nominations. The latest film Erwin Winkler produced, Betrayed, is directed by Costa Gavras, and it opens August 26th. It's a political thriller set in America's fields of waving grain. The Midwest farmers are unhappy with the political forces in the country, and we see the inklings of a white supremacist conspiracy to bring down the government. Apparently good-hearted Americans fear the country is infected with what they call Jews, faggots, and Orientals. The film is a political statement and a thriller, and stars Deborah Winger and Tom Berenger. Erwin Winkler, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
How'd you first get the idea of doing a film on white supremacists?
Well, I happened to read a story in the Los Angeles Times some years ago, and it was a reporter had gone undercover and had infiltrated a terrorist group, a very, very extreme right-wing group up in Northern California. And it was a very, very short article recounting his experiences while he was with this particular group. And it intrigued me. And then about the same time, I read about the Alan Berg murder. He was the talk show host in Denver that was murdered on his way home from the station one night. And it turned out that he was murdered by a group of right-wing when I say right wing, by the way, I mean really extremist right wing. Nothing. We have no statement or no feelings as far as any political reasons against any right wing thinking.
You're talking almost about paramilitary organizations.
Exactly. These are modern day Ku Klux Klanners, and I say modern day because I think we all still have the vision of Ku Klux Klanners as men that ride around in white robes over their face. These are people that are very seemingly ordinary. They're our neighbors next door. They're a lot more dangerous because they don't wear any Nazi badges on their uniforms. Anyhow, I got the it all kind of came together with the Berg murder. That interested me a great deal. We started to do some research, and as we dug into it, we found that it was a story that was perking underneath the consciousness of almost all thinking Americans. However, it was a story that never was on page one of the major newspapers. The stories always seemed to be on page eight, somewhere in the back of the page.
What about Costa Gavras appealed to you, a Greek-born, French-resident director, to do a film about the American heartland?
Well, he's somebody that's always been in the forefront of political thinking, whether it was Latin America as far as Missing is concerned, or the film that won the Academy Award that he directed many years ago called Z, which dealt with the Greek generals in Greece, which is his own native country. And other films such as State of Siege, which dealt with the Argentinian terrorists. And Costa's had a long history of involvement with political subjects. So he seemed to be a natural for me to approach.
But there also seems to be a political sensibility that you have as a producer that runs as a theme through many of your films. What themes appeal to you as a producer that you'd like to see up there on the screen?
Well, I don't think it's the themes themselves that appeal to me. It's really the characters. I'm constantly, as someone pointed out some years ago, almost all my films are about the same thing, and that is how people respond to in a particular situation. Whether it's Rocky and the way he responds when he's given an opportunity to fight and for the championship, or it's Jake LaMotta in Raging Bull, how he responds. Or it's Chuck Yeager and how he responds to his situation. Or Jane Fonda responds to the pressure that she did in one of my earlier films called They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And this is a theme, again, of how the character that Deborah Winger plays responds to her situation. And so the political aspects aside, I seem to be more interested in the characterization and how these people respond in a pressure situation. Some respond well, some don't, obviously.
How much of this is a reflection of your own experience in life as a film producer? There was a time when you began producing films where you really had to struggle. You barely had airfare to get to London to take a look at your first film.
Yeah.
The making of Rocky was a great struggle for you to make.
Well, Rocky was a... Yeah, nobody wanted to make Rocky, and Bob Chartoff and I ended up investing a lot of our meager resources, and believe me, they were meager at the time. I wouldn't tell my wife what we had invested of our own, you know, few dollars to make that picture. Yes, it was a struggle for many, many years, and the struggle now is not a financial one. The struggle now is to make films that will somehow entertain people, but also say something to people, maybe move them a little bit. And I think what we're trying to do is make films that not have a message per se, but are worth spending 2 hours in the theater for somebody to see, but also spending an hour, a year of your life in making it. Why invest a year into something that's frivolous?
You came to this idea of making Betrayed while you were actually working on Round Midnight,
right.
The story of Bud Powell, which starred Dexter Gordon. You were shooting in Paris at the time. How frequent is it that you're working ahead on projects while you're in the midst of another one?
Well, not too much. It's an interesting story. Around Midnight is because it Marty Scorsese and I were returning from Israel, where we were looking for locations for The Last Temptation of Christ, because I was the original producer. I bought the book from the Kazantzakis estate and financed the Paul Schrader screenplay and was involved in making the film. So Marty and I were returning from Israel, where we were looking for locations, and he said that Bertrand Tavernier was had admired some of the things I had done and wanted to meet me, and we all had lunch together. And Bertrand and I started talking about our mutual love for jazz, and that film came out of that luncheon. Interesting enough, if you remember Around Midnight, we used Marty Scorsese as the New York agent for Dexter Gordon.
Well,
so
they're always...
It all comes around, and last night I saw The Last Temptation of Christ, as a matter of fact, at a screening.
Now, I want to ask you about that. Do you regret no longer being the producer of that film?
Yeah, I always regretted it, but what happened is we were right in the midst of the right stuff, and we just couldn't do both at the same time. They both came together at the same time. The right stuff was a big commitment of time and energy. The logistics of making that film were very, very difficult, and we just couldn't let that one go and just jump on to Last Temptation. So we sat down with Marty, and we worked with him as long as we could on it, and when we were physically unable to do so, we bowed out, and we're still close friends. As a matter of fact, the next film that I produce is Marty is going to direct it, as a matter of fact. So.
What will that be?
It's a film by Nick Pileggi. It's called Wise Guys right now, but it's we're going to have to change the title because there's a television series by the same name.
But that's the story of a guy who's told all about the mafia and his sort of low-level experience in it. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. And that we're going to start in March or April, in the spring.
Well, I want to go back a bit to The Last Temptation of Christ.
Okay.
There's a great deal of brouhaha about the film and people saying it's made Jesus far too human. Could you sort of sense this as a controversy that was coming when you and Martin Scorsese were first working on the project?
Well, yeah. I knew something was brewing because people were constantly misunderstanding whatever Marty had planned to do. As a matter of fact, after seeing the film last night, it's what I always felt in the screenplay and certainly always felt in the Kazantzakis book, and that was that this was an affirmation of Christ rather than a... people say it's a humanization of Christ. That may be so. I think this, what it is really is an affirmation of faith on the part of Marty, and it's a very, very moving portrayal of Christ. And I dare say if the people that are critical of it have seen the film or had seen the film, they would be certainly a lot less critical of it. I think the public will speak for themselves. It's a very, very moving, important motion picture.
And isn't all this protest really a wonderful windfall for the producer?
I don't know. I can't say. I think the film stands on its own. I think if they had had it to do over again, I think they would probably have avoided it because the attacks have become very personal. They've become anti-Semitic in a great sense of the word, and I think that's unfortunate. I think Marty has handled it very well. I think the studio Universal has handled it very well. And I think the right wing is, the Jerry Falwells, who make speeches claiming the blasphemy of the movie without having seen it, is very unfortunate.
My guest is movie producer Erwin Winkler. His new project is the Costa Gavras film Betrayed, which is set in the world of white supremacists in the Midwest. Winkler's other films include Raging Bull, The Right Stuff, Round Midnight, and all four Rocky films. Any plans to make a Rocky V?
Yeah, we were just talking about it this morning. We think we have a good story. Sylvester has been working on it for the last couple of months, and we're planning it. Yes, we're going to do a Rocky V.
Anything you can say about it as far as its setting?
Well, I think we're going to go back to some of the earlier qualities that Rocky had in the very first film. I think it's going to be... I think it's going to deal with the human condition and where a man is at in his own life rather than extolling the virtues of the body beautiful.
Well, that was one of the appeals of Rocky. It captured also Philadelphia, rough and raw, and Rocky, the film, had that sort of look to it. And it was part of a whole movement of regional films that really kind of paid homage to different parts of the country. It got the movie industry out of L.A.
Right. One of the people that we had offered the film to when we were trying to get the financing for it said, "You mean to say you want to make a film in Philadelphia? Nobody goes to Philadelphia." Well, we had a good time in Philadelphia, and a lot of people go to Philadelphia, and there's a lot of good reasons to go there.
You know, one of the most memorable scenes of Rocky turned out to be almost an accident, an afterthought, which was where Rocky runs up the stairs of the Philadelphia Museum of Art and throws his fists in the air, cheering and overlooking the whole city of Philadelphia. How much of what makes great moments in movies is accidental? How much of it is right there on the screenplay that you can see as you turn the page?
Well, that was an accident. That was an idea. It wasn't an accident, but it was an idea that Sylvester and John Avildsen had at the last moment. We were shooting in Philadelphia and heading back towards some shooting in New York, and I left on late Friday afternoon. The company was supposed to leave that night. And I stopped off in New York to see my family on the way out to L.A., and Avildsen and Stallone came up with this idea of running up and down the stairs, and they couldn't find me, so they found Bob Chartoff, and it was kind of an off-the-cuff thing, and they said, "Do you think we could do it?" And he asked how much it would cost, and it wasn't very expensive, and he said, "Go ahead and shoot it," and there it was. And then Bill Conti came up with this great score for that scene, and... It was an accident because it wasn't planned, but it was somebody's idea to make it all work, and that's never accidental because after the raw footage came in, somebody had to know what to do with it, and a lot of people jumped in and were able to do that.
You made Rocky One for what, about $1 million at the time?
Yep, just about a little over $1 million, yes.
How much would it cost you to make that movie today, the same conditions?
Well, I mean, if I still paid Sylvester Stallone $75,000, that same film, excluding the salaries of the stars, probably would cost about $12 to $13 million, excluding the salary of the stars.
Mm. And you would have probably had an even more difficult time convincing anyone to underwrite it.
Yeah, it's always tough to convince people to finance things that are a little different. As a matter of fact, when I get into a situation where somebody is free with their money on something that I want to do and there isn't any difficulty in raising the financing, I'm going to question it a great deal because then I think you're walking into a trap. I think you have to try to be innovative. You have to try to be different. There's nothing wrong with making Rocky 2, 3, and 4. What's right about it is making Rocky 1, is finding a subject that people tell you is of no interest, that there's somebody involved in the production, in this case, the actor, that nobody wants and nobody's interested in, and making that work. That's exciting, and that's what filmmaking should be. It should be a little bit innovative. It should try to take some chances. If it stops taking chances, the chances are that you're going to get boring and not very original.
There's a line in Rocky that I like that I think speaks to this, and that's where the bartender turns to Rocky and says, "Me, I got a business to run. I don't take no shots." And that seemed almost sort of a metaphor for the way some Hollywood producers behave, almost on the safe side.
Well, yeah, I think it's a metaphor for life, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the truth about a lot of people.
I'm speaking with Hollywood producer Irwin Winkler. He produced the new Costa Gavras film, Betrayed. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Irwin Winkler is my guest. During his long career in Hollywood, he produced Elvis Presley's Double Trouble, worked with Martin Scorsese on Raging Bull and New York, New York, and watched his regional independent film, Rocky, turn into one of Hollywood's biggest success stories. He's just produced a new film by Costa Gavras called Betrayed, which is a thriller set among white supremacists in the American Midwest. Raging Bull, another boxing film he made starring Robert De Niro, is an entirely different kind of boxing film. I mean, I guess boxing is pretty much a sport about a story of domination. And what appealed to you about the script that was so different from the way the Rocky story went?
Well, the approach to Raging Bull was quite different than Rocky, obviously. The approach there was, as far as we were always concerned, we were doing a buddy film, probably the underside of the buddy film. But we were really trying to examine the relationship between Jake LaMotta and his brother and how violence in the ring becomes a factor in the violence of life, that there's no way to separate your life in the ring from your life away from the ring. Jake turns out to be a man who is examined very, very carefully under a microscope in the nature of his relationship to his brother. I don't know if a lot of people saw that because the film had its own life and its own meaning to a lot of people, but that's what we started out to do. We started out to examine both these men and how they affected each other.
What about the choice of shooting it in black and white? Was this a producer's decision, a director's decision? How did you and Martin Scorsese discuss this?
Well, somebody mentioned it and had the idea. I don't recall who. And we all thought it was kind of interesting because we wanted to do, in some way, a homage to, you know, the film noirs of the 40s and 50s. And it's just something that just generated amongst us, and we talked about it and talked about it, and it seemed like a good idea. Again, we had a great deal of difficulty with the financiers because of that. Again, the story was that you know, television stations won't want to play it because it's in black and white and all that stuff. And then I think Woody Allen did a film in black and white at just about that time, and it was fairly successful, and suddenly nobody objected that violently to it anymore.
What was that? That was Manhattan, I guess.
I think so.
Yeah. Well, how much trouble do you have with financiers? I mean, in Hollywood, the pitch is notorious. It's legendary. I mean, people are always pitching ideas to one another. What is the producer's pitch to the financiers? How do you try to sell them on a film that you're making?
You know, each film really has to be sold on its own merits or lack of merits. I don't know how I do it, really. It's always difficult. Betrayed, we really sold it because it was a film that was a thriller. We had found an original way to present a character in a very, very tense situation. And which has always been the background of the film, we had very little trouble on Betrayed. Usually there's a great deal more difficulty. The studio was very anxious, United Artists in that case, was very anxious to do it because they thought that there was a good market for this kind of film.
How much are movies nowadays driven by marketing? I mean, are you susceptible to the pressure to use screenings to test endings and to test content of a film?
Oh yeah, we're not immune to it. It's becoming a research is becoming a crutch for most of the studios, and it's a crutch based on the lack of show business experience and the lack of trusting their own instincts. There is no, you know, when you get lawyers and accountants running companies, they don't trust any creative instinct, and what they want to do is go by numbers. And research is easy because you get back numbers. Seven people say they don't like this scene. Four people say they like that ending. And you could put it up on a chart and you could say, well, this is what we should do. So I think sometimes the research works for marketing, but as far as making films are concerned, if we're not careful, we're going to send our stories out to research before we even write them. I dare say if you did a research study and you said, well, we have this film about this overweight Italian bum in Philadelphia who breaks arms for a living and improbably gets a shot at the world championship and then loses, they'll say to you, well, I'll tell you what, research tells us that women don't like to see films of violence. Boxing has been banned in a great deal of the European countries. Japan, sumo wrestling is the big indoor sport. His girlfriend is an ugly duckling by the name of, played by Talia Shire. There's absolutely no way. Your music is going to be done by Bill Conti, who is a jazz pianist in a bar in Venice. This is what you want us to, in Philadelphia? And you want to star Sylvester Stallone? Come on. Research will tell you you're crazy. So nobody's going to go see this movie.
How do you fight that trend now? I mean, are you under pressure to do that? Do people should show Betrayed in a theater and turned in responses?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank God the response has been good, so the pressure hasn't been too bad. But sure, you can't avoid the financier saying, look, we've invested $12 or $13 million, and you know, we'd like to run it in a theater and see how it plays. In this case, the film has played very well, so we haven't had a lot of feedback. If it hadn't played well, we might have gotten a different kind of response.
Your early work in the show business industry was with the William Morris Agency, mm-hmm. working as an agent and also as a clapper. What is a clapper?
Well, what I did in the early... I used to get $5 for... going to television shows and clapping, literally cheering. At a bad joke that wasn't getting a response, I would applaud or laugh and try to create some more reaction amongst my fellow audience members. And I worked two shows a week, and I got $10 a week doing that.
And then what took you into the big time?
I guess now we have canned applause, so canned I guess it's the same.
Saves on the money, right.
Yeah.
What took you into the world then of movie producing? How did you get from being a clapper into working on films?
Well, that's a long story. It'll take more than 40 minutes to tell that story.
Uh-oh. Well, let me ask you a question then. I understand one of your early projects was originally designed for Julie Christie, but somehow the Hollywood studio said, no, actually it's more suitable as a vehicle for Elvis Presley?
That's right. We had met the president of MGM. His name was Robert O'Brien, and I guess that was about 1965. And we had the script, and we gave it to him to read, and he said, "Oh, I think this is a terrific script, and but I don't think it's right for Julie Christie. I'd like to do it with Elvis Presley." And we were very anxious. We said, "Gee, what a great idea!" And before we knew it, we were on an airplane out to Hollywood producing a film with Elvis Presley.
And that was before audiences measured their responses to...
That's right. But I'll tell you, there's a sad story about Elvis Presley, who I didn't know well, but I knew him enough. We spent 6 months making a film together. He was a terrific, very, very nice young man. I say young man, I think he was older than I am, but he was a very nice person. And the thing I remember the most about Presley was... His career was already starting to head towards a twilight as far as films were concerned. And he had surrounded himself with, I guess there were 30-some-odd in his entourage, guys that would just bring him a towel when he sweated, and a guy that would bring him a cold glass of water when he wanted that. And all of them had Cadillac cars, as I remember it. And they had a good thing going. And I remember as they would head out the studio at the end of the day, he had this big limousine. I think it was a Rolls Royce. I didn't know much about Rolls Royces in those days, but I think it was a Rolls Royce. And they used to, as they approached the gates of MGM, they used to say to Elvis, okay, get down now. And he'd get down on the floor of the car, and they'd throw this big rug over him. And they'd do that so that the crowds outside wouldn't attack him. The sad thing about that was there were no more crowds outside, but Elvis never really knew it because he was always under that blanket. And to me, it's the sad story of Elvis Presley. He never knew they weren't out there anymore.
That's a terrifying story about Hollywood.
Yeah, it is.
What do you think is a producer's greatest virtue, or at least your greatest virtue?
The greatest virtue a producer has is an ability to read and maybe write a little bit. But if I had to give an abject lesson in producing, I'd say don't go to film school. I wouldn't recommend anybody ever going to film school, by the way. I would say learn how to read and write. Read the classics. Read some good Russian literature. Read the American classics. Get a good background in classical literature, because you better learn how to know a good story from a bad one.
What's on your bedstand at the moment for your reading material?
Naming Names, a book about the blacklisting in Hollywood in the 50s, and I'm reading the Kazan book, My Life.
Yeah, it's a study of character.
Kazan's apology for naming names ties right into the book of Nevasky's, which deals with the Hollywood blacklisting of the 50s.
And that gets back to your interest in study of character.
Yep, and it's probably going to be the next film I do, as a matter of fact.
Well, thank you very much for coming in, and I appreciate you taking
the time.
Well,
it's a pleasure.
Erwin Winkler's new film, Betrayed, is scheduled to open on August 26th. It's directed by Costa Gavras and stars Deborah Winger and Tom Berenger. It's a thriller that looks into the world of violent white supremacists in the American Midwest. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.